for tuning back into the Mystery Stone Podcast. Once again, I am CJ here with
Magic Mike. How you guys doing?
Oh.
What's up, homies?
Magic Mike this time, huh?
Hey, man. Every day a new chapter.
So appropriate for our topic today.
I know, right?
Oh. Ugh. What does...
Religious Mike? How's that?
But yeah, today we are covering more foundational work for you guys. Hooray!
Woohoo! Confetti everywhere. What's up, man?
Yeah. We're going to talk to you guys a little bit about spiritual and holy texts today. I'll just kind of give you an opportunity to really think about some of the books that are out there and some of the things that you could be reading to support you along your spiritual path or magical journey or wherever it is you're headed right now. Like I said previously, we are steadily moving into more specific topics, but this is going to be another sort of broad one just to give you an idea of where you really can be looking.
Yeah, and this episode will also be kind of a complimentary episode to a previous one we did that was titled Religious and Spiritual Traditions, and this will at least go into the foundational works or texts that are affiliated with some of the primary religions that are out there, at least some of the most prominent. You know, there's like a billion different types of holy texts or spiritual texts out there in general. I mean, there's been so many religions and paths of life, but we're going to be covering some of the more prominent holy texts that are out there, at least with the primary religions that are around. So, yeah.
And just like that previous episode, we are keeping the order that we talk about things time relevant as to the oldest first and up to the newest.
Yeah. So with that said, religious spiritual texts across the centuries have played a huge role in the production and manufacturing of culture and society, interestingly enough. And like these books are so powerful that they've weaved their way into the minds of millions and millions and millions of people for thousands of years and have organized, you know, cultures and structures of morality and how civilization should operate and how, you know, how the mind should function and proper paths in the life that you should take. You know, they're kind of like, you know, kind of like street signs along the way, you know, to get to your destination safely, so to speak, through wisdom and storytelling, or, you know, whether you believe a lot of this stuff is literal, metaphysical, figurative, you know, at the end of the day, if used properly, a lot of them do provide a lot of practical and insightful knowledge as to how to weave your way through life. So, well, with that said, I guess today we're going to start with Hinduism, because Hinduism is one of the most prominent and widespread religions still to this day, and I believe it rose from like 1500 BC, which is actually when the first book we're speaking about today would be the Vedas. And the Vedas is the oldest scriptures of Hinduism, and the Vedas is a Sanskrit word which means knowledge or wisdom. And in total, there are four parts of the Vedas, or four Vedas in general. There's the Rig Veda, which is the oldest known complete religious text, the Yajurveda, the Samaveda, and the Atharvaveda. And if I mess up any of these words, you know, pronunciations for a lot of these things, my bad. But there's a lot of culture differences. I'm from America, so a lot of these things I've come to know or whatever, you know, they might have different connotations or sounds or whatever that I'm saying, but I'm going to do my best.
Yeah, keep in mind that a lot like you as a listener, we learn most of these words through reading.
Yeah, yeah. And like the reading, there's no like little audible button, you know, audio button there next to all the words that we don't know. So yeah, in terms of the Vedas, yeah, there's four in total, the ones I just mentioned. They were written between 1500 BC and 900 BC. And the Vedas in general, which once more are one of the most primary texts for Hinduism, they deal specifically with mantras, benedictions, rituals, and ceremonies. So it kind of covers like a lot of the foundational, I guess, tenets or just foundational ways of life or how to deal with certain situations of life that spawned in Hinduism.
Yeah, they deal with everything from weddings to spiritual sites to philosophy and even political mindsets.
Yeah, so I guess it kind of just overall a structure of society and how, I guess, the skeletal frame should work, right? In a sense, in a spiritual sense, I suppose.
Yeah.
Less carnal.
Really, like, how you should operate yourself among a group.
Yeah.
You know, you're working together to achieve a thing. It gives you some order.
Yeah, just allow people to get along and stop fighting over, you know, territory and blades of grass and all, and et cetera. But yeah, the next, in terms of Hinduism, we come to the Upanishads. And the Upanishads, honestly, I've read some of the principal Upanishads in the past. But in general, there's different speculations as to how many in total, and certain, you know, certain groups say different things or whatever. But overall, there's formally 108 Upanishads in total. And some will say that there's 10 principal Upanishads, and others will say there's 13 principal Upanishads. I specifically read a book a while ago, which even to this day, I've read a lot of books, and in the spiritual, mystical, occult, metaphysical area, etc. And it still remains one of the best books I've read, one of the most concise books I've read in the history of all of the books I've read so far. And that is called Breath of the Eternal, the Upanishads, the Wisdom of the Hindu Mystics. And that was written by Swami Prabhavananda. It's a little book. It's very concise. I might want to say there's like 150 pages. I don't remember exactly how big it was, but it's a nice little handheld book. You know, and it goes over a lot of metaphysical aspects and mystical aspects of Hinduism. It deals with meditation, philosophy, spiritual knowledge, and things of that sort. If I remember correctly, it speaks about like Atman, you know, the soul, Brahman, which is ultimate reality. You know, with the self, your correlation to the universe, your correlation to God, you know, everything in general like that. It's more of like an esoteric work, more of an in-depth, profound work, as opposed to maybe, say, like a structural work such as, you know, the Vedas.
They say it's actually like a companion for the Vedas. It's the ends of mm-hmm. the Vedas.
Yeah, they're the most comprehensive and parts of the Vedas, and they're at the end of all the Vedas. So If anyone were to read anything involving Hinduism, aside from the next work that we're about to talk about, I would definitely highly consider looking into the Upanishads, or at least the principal ones, which can be found in the book I just mentioned, or various other ones.
Especially if you're going to be looking into your own self for spiritual contemplation, because the Upanishads really emphasize spiritual contemplation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, contemplation, meditation, things along those sorts. Like I was saying, it's more of a metaphysical book, more of an esoteric book, and it gets down real to like the spiritual source of Hinduism in general. Let's see. Next, we'll be speaking about the Bhagavad Gita. I'm sure a lot of you guys have heard about that one. The Bhagavad Gita is one of the most famous Hindu works, and it's written in like a story form. And the term Bhagavad Gita is Sanskrit for Song of God, and it was authored by a sage named Vyasa around 200 BC, or at least it was speculated to be authored by Vyasa. And also, just for the notice, Vyasa was apparently the author for the Upanishads as well. Of course, it's speculation, but yeah, it's about that. But yeah, in terms of how the story goes, how does the story typically operate, or like what's a
it's a conversation between Krishna, who is the avatar of Vishnu. If anybody's wondering what that means, it's an incarnation of Vishnu. So
I think it's like the preserver in Hinduism,
right? Krishna is the incarnation of a god, and he's having a conversation with a priest whose name slips my mind. Not a priest, a prince whose name slips my mind at this time. It was just before a very large war. And he's discussing with this prince over the course of 700 verses, basically just how to live a balanced and happy life. That's really where it's at for that. It's basically just how to lead a fulfilling life.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the books in Hinduism I've always wanted to read. I actually have the Bhagavad Gita as well, but I just never got into it. I have a version which is apparently pretty renowned, one of the better versions around today. It's just called, you know, the Bhagavad Gita, and it's by the author Eknath Iswaran. At least I believe that's how you pronounce it. But it's a beautiful looking book. It's blue, gold border, and it's one of the most common translations that we have today in English.
Yeah, mine's 671 pages long, so this is a
man. That's a sit down, huh?
Yeah. Well, if anybody's wondering, I'm actually holding a copy of it right now because I have one as well, and it says His Divine Grace AC. Oh wow, You want to give that name?
Yeah, these names get a little wild out here. Yeah, okay, so it's by AC, at least the one that CJ here has, is by AC Bhaktivedanta and Swami. No, actually, I think it's one word. I think it's one name. AC Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada.
That was better than anything I was going to come up with.
You know, no disrespect, but that one definitely was a hardcore read.
Yeah, my Western brain, there's no way I can pronounce those words, at least not without offending a good portion of the planet. I'm not even going to try that.
Yeah, which, you know, that's not the intent, of course. But, yeah, so Bhagavad Gita, one of the most central parts of Hinduism. And next, after Hinduism spawned, as we know, if following the previous episode on religious and spiritual practices, would be Buddhism. Buddhism is an offshoot of Hinduism and came later on through Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha himself. And the primary book in Buddhism is a book called, it's an interestingly named book, it's called Tripitaka or Tipitaka, which actually means three baskets. And this was composed in 550 BC, or at least I think it was composed between the time periods of 550 BC and the first century AD. And in this book, there's three categories. There's the Sutra Pitaka, the Vinaya Pitaka, and the Abhinama Pitaka. So yeah, I guess those are the three baskets of the Tripitaka. Very interesting. It's a very interesting name.
Yeah, the whole thing focuses on dress code, diet, and then the teachings of Buddha.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Basically, how to carry yourself as an individual and spiritually.
So I guess maybe it would be kind of like semi-equivalent to like the Vedas, or like kind of like a structural or skeletal approach, you know, to Buddhism in essence. I've never read that one particularly.
Really I found interesting with this is, short of the Bible, I don't know of a religious text that really says much about dress code. I mean, the Bible itself talks about you shouldn't mix fabrics, I think is how that works.
Yeah, you know, I went to Catholic school most of my life, dude, and, like, I can't really remember, like, what to wear, not to wear, besides you can't have tattoos, or you can't wear you can't have, like, long hair, I think, or, like, you can't wear linen. I think another one is
You're not supposed to wear linens that are made out, like, two different, like, your shirt shouldn't be cotton where your pants are polyester or whatever, like, or your tunic shouldn't be wool and your shirt be made of cotton, and it should all be made out of the same stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know. Like, I'm not here to judge what's right or wrong in terms of etiquette or how to dress properly. But it's interesting, you know, how different cultures range and like the things they're allowed to wear, they don't wear, or what spiritual or what their spiritual practices allow them to wear, and you know the significance it has. And it's very fascinating.
I heard a theory about that specifically. I know we're supposed to be talking about Buddhism, but when it comes to the dress code itself, I heard a theory one time a number of years ago that it was sort of like bragging if you were wearing multiple types of clothing.
Maybe it's kind of like an exaggeration or like an expression of the ego or whatever is not of the
something
spirit.
That. Yeah. I don't know what sort of informational backing that theory has, but it was something that somebody had said to me that I thought was interesting. And I never bothered really to look into it myself, which I probably should have, but dress code never really mattered so much to me. I don't know specifically what the Tipitaka has in it in accordance with dress code. Because monks dress similarly depending on the regions they're from.
Yeah, just like robes and stuff like that.
Some of them shave their heads, some of them don't. So I don't really know what the specifics are behind it, but I'd actually be kind of interested to take a look at that. Do you have anything else on the Tipitaka?
Not in that book in general, should I say. Okay. But there is in modern times an extremely prominent Buddhist teacher, and I don't want to butcher his name or anything. But from what I remember, his name is something along the lines of Thich Nhat Hanh. He's become a really prominent Buddhist teacher in modern times, and he's came out with significant amount of works. A lot of books I honestly eventually want to get into and start reading. I've never really got into Buddhism too much personally. I've always been interested in what it's been about and the path in general, but just never really fully been called to really delve into it deeply. And some of Thich Nhat Hanh's books, one of the primary books I wanted to read by him is a book called The Heart of the Buddha's Teachings. You can actually find him on YouTube. You can find him all over the place. He has many, many books, like I said. And you can find him doing videos online, a lot of question and answers, stuff like that. So if anyone's looking for like modern spiritual books or spiritual texts on Buddhism, he's definitely one I would highly suggest.
We do have another Buddhist book, the Dhammapada.
The Dhammapada?
I think that's how you say that word.
Okay.
And pretty much the Dhammapada is primarily for Theravada Buddhism. And it was originally called the Kudaka Nikaya.
Okay.
And what this book is, it's the sayings of Buddha written in verse form.
Interesting. Okay, so it's essentially supposed to be like the dialogue of Buddha.
Correct.
Okay, that's kind of similar to like the hadith in Islam, which we'll get to in a little, towards the end. But yeah, so it's like just the commentaries. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Like, so like with Buddhism, you have Buddhism that spans beyond like Japan and China. It goes down into India, and I believe it's actually present in some places in Africa.
Okay, I can see that.
But like, if you look at the Buddhas from India, the Buddha from China, Buddha from Japan, you have all these different ones. Like, Gautama was the first, and then there were several Buddhas after him.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
He's like the primary guy.
Yeah, and Buddha itself just means like the enlightened one, or just one who's enlightened. Mm-hmm. It wasn't his name or anything like that. It was a name that was given to him.
That's why you end up with Buddhas that look like real skinny, sitting there with super elongated earlobes, like really like crazy gauged.
Yeah, stretched earlobes.
Yeah, and then you have the fat guy who sits there with jade in his belly, and
he's like smiling and laughing, having a great old time.
Yeah, yeah. And that's how you end up with all these different ones. But the Dhammapada is for Theravada Buddhists primarily. I mean, obviously anybody can mingle with that if they want to. They can, but that's the text they prefer.
Awesome, interesting. Yeah, all right. So after Buddhism, one of the more primary religions that have emerged, it was Judaism. That's a big one. And still exists today, of course, obviously, on an extreme wide scale. And some of the primary books or texts in Judaism involve the Tanakh, which is the Hebrew Bible, as they call it. And this consists of 24 books, and it has three divisions, which includes the Torah, which means teaching in Hebrew. And the Torah was essentially the first five books of Moses that Moses wrote. And in the Old Testament, in the Standard Bible, the first five books, including Genesis, and I think Deuteronomy and a couple, of course, three others, that is the Torah, one of the central books in Judaism, written by Moses once more. So yeah, continuing on the three divisions, we have the Torah, or the teaching, the Nevi'im, which means prophets, and the Ketuvim, which means writings. So those are the three divisions of Tanakh, or the Hebrew Bible.
And they're all under the Masoretic text.
Yeah, Masoretic, right? I've heard that word before.
So all 24 books are considered the Masoretic texts.
Okay, interesting, yeah. So we have that. Second to that, we have the Talmud. This has been a controversial topic. A lot of people claim some interesting beliefs or practices to be involved in the Talmud. But overall, it's a very interesting, it's a very long compilation of texts or words. And there's two components in the Talmud. We have the Mishnah, which means study by repetition. And this was the first major written collection of Jewish oral tradition, which was compiled in 200 AD. And the second component to the Mishnah is Gemara, or Gemara, or however you pronunciate that. And that essentially was the elucidation of the Mishnah. It went to more detail with the components and elements of the Mishnah and elaborates on it a lot further. So that involves the Talmud. You'll see, I think, a lot of Zionists. I could be wrong on this. Zionists, or just a lot of just rabbinical Judaism utilizes the Talmud heavily. And that's where a lot of Jewish law and comes from, just a lot of lifestyles and how to teach your children, etiquette, morality, things along those lines can be found in there. And from what I remember, it's an extremely, like I said, extensive compilation of texts. So there's the Talmud. Third that's essential in Judaism is the Kabbalah. And I don't want to delve into this too much here. Of course, we're doing kind of like an overview here. But the Kabbalah deals with mystic Judaism, and that kind of goes beyond just a regular religious or spiritual path. But the Kabbalah is one we're going to have our own episode on coming up in the near future, and it's one of the most fascinating topics, in my opinion. It's one of the most profound, and it deals heavily with, you know, the magic side of things that we delve into here and there on this podcast. So with the Kabbalah, the Kabbalah is kind of a mystical tradition that spawned from various different books. You have the Sefer Yetzirah, which is in English, from Hebrew, it's Sefer Yetzirah. In English, it means Book of Formation. And there's a lot of speculation on when these things were written, who authored these works. They're ancient texts, so no one knows 100% for sure. But I've read that they could have came from 3000 BC, as old as that, or even just a lot more earlier than that. But nothing too close to the first century AD. But definitely as an ancient text, probably thousands of years ago, it was written down. And if I remember correctly, the Sefer Yetzirah, it's a short book. There's different versions of the Sefer Yetzirah. There's like the short version, there's a long version. There's different versions of it. And I fortunately have read a really, really good version of the Sefer Yetzirah for anyone who's looking into it. And if anyone's into the metaphysical side of things or the Kabbalah or anything along those lines, I heavily, heavily would refer to you to get this book. It's a blue cover, and it's titled Sefer Yetzirah, The Book of Creation in Theory and Practice by an eminent and prominent author, Arye Kaplan. And he's been an extremely prominent and important author of modern times involving Kabbalistic texts, ancient Jewish texts, and just the elaboration of meditation involving Kabbalah and Kabbalah in general. He's brought to light a lot of important information that otherwise would have remained occulted or hidden. And just a lot of things he's brought to the light that would have been hard to have got your hands on. Arye Kaplan, his version I would highly suggest. And the book is a beautiful book. It's beautiful the way the cover looks, how the book feels, how it's written. And inside that work by him, it contains all of the prominent versions of the Sefer Yetzirah, and it breaks it down like really heavily. It breaks it down really heavily from the Hebrew into English and what it actually means metaphysically, mathematically, and how it pertains to the actual creation of the world, the mind of God, etc. So yeah, Sefer Yetzirah was one of the first books that went on to be important in the Kabbalistic way of life. Second, we have the Sefer Bahir, which in English means the Book of Illumination. And that was written, they say, around 1st century AD. Arye Kaplan, once more, has an amazing, from what I've read in terms of the reviews, he has an amazing work of the translation from that, and he explains it very well. And that's a book that I definitely aim on reading in the future to complement Sefer Yetzirah. And thirdly, the foundational work of the Kabbalah would be the Zohar. A lot of you guys might have heard that one, maybe not, but it means in English, splendor or radiance. And from the Zohar, it speaks a lot about, once more, like the metaphysics of the world, you know, the soul, a being, the self, God, a lot of the esoteric side of Judaism, a lot of the metaphysical side of Judaism. And that, in essence, I believe, is where the Kabbalistic tree of life came from. You know, of course, with the Old Testament as well, they got a lot of the stuff from the Old Testament in terms of how the tree of life is formulated, the Sephiras and all that stuff. But we're going to go into that in much depth in the future. And that's kind of veering off course of traditional religions. And the Zohar was written to finalize that on my side in the 13th century AD. I'm not sure if you have anything involving Judaism or anything like that to supplement.
No.
These things. Okay.
No.
Yeah. So yeah. And that pretty much sums up the entire, the eminent works in Judaism. There's so much more that aren't as prominent in Judaism, depending on how deep you are, as a Jew, you know, in terms of like esoteric or just regular. But, the Jewish typically only deal, with the Old Testament. And they do not believe that Jesus was the Son of God or, you know, or the prophet or anything like that. They don't really deal too much with the New Testament or Jesus. That's when Christianity comes into play. So we have Christianity. one of the most prominent world religions today. A lot of people are very...
There's a lot of controversy involved when it comes to the New Testament. A lot.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot. Me personally, you know, I was raised with Christianity, Catholicism more specifically, pretty hardcore. I went to preschool, Christian preschool. I went all the way up till 10th grade. I was in the Catholic school, being instilled in my mind the things of that. And if you guys have listened to previous episodes, we went a little bit in depth onto our past with Catholicism, things, you know, our past involving that. And so in terms of Christianity, we have the Bible. I'm sure you guys heard of the Bible. Maybe not, but the Bible in English means book.
I think it 6 billion copies printed. I'm pretty sure every single one of us have at least heard of it.
Yeah, I believe the Bible is. Yeah, it's like I think that the Bible is the number one most selling book in the world.
Yeah, that's actually that's one of the things. That's where I got the 6 billion number from.
Oh, interesting.
Legitimately, okay. It's been printed 6 billion times.
That's like almost as many people are in the world like to date.
Yeah,
it's fascinating.
Real close.
It is, yeah. And, what was I going to say about Christianity? It's interesting that back in the day, there's this book called The Elements by a mathematician and philosopher Euclid. And that, at the time, I think superseded the most sold book of all time. It was a math book, and Abraham Lincoln had one on his bedstand to keep his mind sharp. But that's a little digression, a little fun fact, you know, just how a math text and the Bible were like kind of like head to head in terms of like the histories of books' prominence in the world. Coming back to the Bible, there's many different churches, many different branches, many different canonical ideas as to like, you know, how the Bible is in their practice.
Yeah, that's where we come into the whole realm of controversy with it. Being that right now the most common version, at least that I've heard of, is the King James Version or the KJV. And supposedly that's like the 78th edit of the Bible. The Bible has over 50,000 edits in the KJV version. A lot of people argued that they were mostly spelling mistakes. It's actually not true. Over the course of the medieval ages, kings would have the Bible modified in order to manage the people in the ways that they saw fit. So when you look at these modified versions of the Bible, we do have the books. There are things that edited. So back when we have the Tanakh, that's more of a literal book. Things like that, the Torah, that's literal. Nowadays, many people view the Bible as more allegorical, where we have things like they theorize that the lineage that Jesus would have to King David isn't necessarily accurate, that they added that into the Bible to appeal to Jewish culture.
Interesting.
Yeah. They've left out several books over the course of those edits, including the books that told stories of characters such as Lilith.
Lilith. That's another fascinating character that it's not really too commonly heard of. She's like one of the more, I think she's one of the primordial feminine humans, female humans.
The story of Lilith is Lilith was created at the same time as Adam and was made from the same dust. Lilith refused to be subservient to Adam and was therefore booted out of the garden, at which point God removed a rib from Adam and created Eve, who was supposed to be subservient to him. The story progresses from there. Lilith at times is... I've heard her referred to as Queen of Demons. I've heard her referred to as Mother of the Nephilim. There's a lot of lore surrounding Lilith and herself. Some of it, she's not really morally nice, I guess. She's not really like a one of the right-hand path. Other times, she's just gray. Like, she's neither good nor bad. She just exists.
Yeah, and all the stuff I've heard about Lilith, I think, all my life, which hasn't been too much. I don't really remember having a good connotation of her or like a good memory of what she stood for. But I don't really know too much about her in general. But yeah, it's weird how like something like that was, relevant to Adam and Eve creation story, and it's just absent from most minds intellect.
There are several books. Like the Vatican possesses the Book of Judas.
Okay, yeah, that's the rebel, man.
Good luck getting them to let you read it.
Yeah, that's another
good
thing.
Good luck with that.
An offshoot, man. The Vatican is a fascinating country because it's its own country. And, you know, they had, like, the secret society Opus Dei there. And they had the Vatican vault there, which to me is kind of like the modern-day Library of Alexandria. I wouldn't even be surprised if some of the books in the Library of Alexandria were somehow down there. Or, like, that's, like, the new...
It really wouldn't shock me either.
Yeah.
It really wouldn't shock... One of the books that they actually have in possession in there was removed very early on in the medieval times. Keep in mind that most of the edits to the New Testament and the Bible itself was done during the medieval times. Obviously, nowadays, with the way culture is now, that's not something that would be well-received by people.
No.
Like, I'm sorry, you took my book and did what with it? back then, the reason that they were able to do that is because the kings and queens were supposedly chosen by divinity. They were sanctified as holy people. Like, they were chosen by God to
yeah.
rule.
Yeah.
So, therefore, them editing the Bible in itself...
It's justified.
Yeah. We are able, we do have texts that go back, pre-edit, and things such as that, but it's very, very tough to really figure out what's been edited, what's not. But the story, one of the stories that was removed, what king was that?
I know Martin Luther, I think, got rid of some books and Lutheranism and stuff like that, but that's something different.
Yeah, there is a book, it's... Sam and something. I can't remember the title of the book, but it was removed because some of the teachings of that book went against the teachings of either Peter or Paul.
And okay.
We actually still possess the copy of that book. Now, keeping in mind, the books that are in the New Testament, we don't have any of the original copies of. What we have is copies of the originals.
I think actually the earliest copy of the Bible that we have is in the Vatican vault. And that is, I believe, called the Codex of something along the lines of the Codex Vaticanus.
Codex
Vaticanus. Or Vaticanus or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that comes from like 4th century AD or something along those lines. I'm not 100% sure, but yeah, so that's interesting. I would definitely love somehow to go see the original or the oldest Bible that we have extant today. You know, I mean, that'd be crazy to be in the surrounding proximity of such an ancient holy scripture, you know?
Yeah, unfortunately, the oldest one that we have is a copy of the original.
Okay.
So the original doesn't exist, or at least is maybe buried somewhere we haven't found it, or is being an extremely well-guarded secret.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like, the Vatican vault in general, man, that vault spans, like, so... It's such a huge, huge, vast underground vault, and, like, you're not even allowed in there. Like, nobody can go in there unless you're, like, a prominent scholar or someone who has a specific book... at least I remember hearing that you need like a specific book that you're looking for and that you want to investigate or look through, and you have to be like a prominent person. And you have to like sign like a petition or like a waiver to like to submit to the Vatican to hopefully get the book out of there and check it out or whatever. But aside from that, there's rows and rows and aisles that go on forever that nobody knows what's down there, nobody knows what's in there, and you're not even allowed to go see it. So I mean that's only a handful of people.
A handful of people allowed to enter that vault. But mind you, those are just some of the controversy issues with the New Testament. I'm not disregarding anybody. Like, if you're like, KJV is the way to go, all right, cool.
Sure.
You know, because who am I to tell you it's not?
Yeah.
But... just informational.
Yeah, absolutely. And the King James version of the KJV, that is what most people would claim is it's the closest that we have in English to the original, quote unquote, the original book, which was written. The Old Testament was in Hebrew, and the New Testament was in Greek. So yeah, and it has like a lot of old English style writing and stuff like that. So a lot of people don't really like it, and to the extent that it's harder on the Western mind's brain to read, interpret, and really get an accurate idea as to, you know, what it's saying. I mean, it's not the worst, it's not the hardest thing in the world. I have a couple King James Version Bibles myself, and I kind of like the way it's written, but it's not the easiest on the eyes. I have a New International Version, and if I'm reading a Bible, that's the one that I primarily like to use. I like the flow words in it. It's a nice style. It elaborates on everything in a nice, fluent way. And but, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of these translations, which so many, there's extreme amounts of different translations on the Bible, like CJ had said, and whichever one it calls to you or whichever one you like, it's not a huge deal, because in the end, a lot of them, they at least say along the lines of the same type of deal, just written different eloquence, different style of writing, or just they use just different words. But there's definitely a lot of differences that you can definitely get different. You can glean like different meanings from a lot of the sentences based off the different interpretations. So that's another, you know, it's a very thin wire you're walking when it comes to trying to find truth with that. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's whatever calls to you. I'm a big fan of the Bible personally. I'll never knock any holy or spiritual text at all. It's just more so what people choose to do with it. You know, humanity ends up being the problem in a lot of things, and it's never the holy text. So, yeah, I have a lot of respect for the Bible and all these texts we're speaking about in general.
There's a lot of documents out there, ancient things, sometimes some of them even the Vatican will let you look at, that corroborates, is that how you pronounce it? Corroborates.
Yeah,
CJ's with it. I'm sober, I promise.
1 point for CJ,
oh
dude.
Oh my God. Wow. But it'll corroborate a lot of the stuff that's actually in the New Testament, so where it's been edited, it's not completely, you know,
Yeah.
You know what I mean.
Yeah. It's there's a lot of complimentary things that occur within it and stuff like that.
Yeah, sometimes people are very interesting when you go to talk to them about the Bible. If you have somebody who can have a civil adult conversation with you, because some people get very emotional when it comes to discussing that particular text.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very powerful too.
Yeah. Like I had somebody recently, I was talking to them about the story of Noah, and he actually tried to tell me that story was less literal, more allegorical.
Okay,
and
which I'd probably agree with that, but I don't, who knows?
The only part that really I had an issue with was the Bible specifies the number of giants killed in that the flood. So when it wiped out the Nephilim, it's a really specific number. Like it's not rounded. It just for argument's sake, it's like 1635. That's not the actual number.
Yeah,
but
0.7.
Yeah, like right.
It's like
a
third of the dude is still alive. It's like okay, man.
I really wish I didn't know I was going to be talking about this. I wish I'd looked the actual number up. But it's a very very specific number.
And
you're like that's really specific to be allegorical. That's a very literal number.
Yeah, and there's a lot of numerological significances in the Bible, especially in Revelation. Seven's brought up like seven trumpets, seven this, seven that. You know, a lot of people, you know, I would probably speculate it's more numerology. You know, there's significances behind it. There's more like occult meanings behind it. And there's a lot of layers to holy texts. You know, some are for the more superficial minded, not in a negative way. Or just, you know, people who give more care to it might go deeper and deeper. And there's different levels of understanding to a lot of these texts. But, you know, it's interesting that in the Bible that deluge, which is, or the deluge, which was the flood, that I believe occurred in the Epic of Gilgamesh, or at least other whole ancient texts as well. Like that same type of flood and stuff like that is very similar. So and I think even historically there was even some type of floods, if I remember correctly, reading. But I'm not 100% certain on that.
There's an archaeological site I read about a number of years ago too that says they actually found Noah's Ark.
Yeah, I've seen that. That one's highly speculative. There's videos on YouTube about that. They like dug it out, I think, from some mountain or in the desert or something like that.
Yeah. And they were saying like, oh, this would never be big enough for that many animals, which given all the miracles performed in the Bible, I really don't think it's too absurd to consider the a quantum mechanic concept called a pocket dimension.
Yeah, right. Like you're like somehow just stuff him in there like some type of metaphysical way or using...
Yeah, if anybody's familiar with the show Doctor Who, he drives around a spaceship called a TARDIS. It's the size of a phone booth on the outside. You walk in, it's enormous. So that's your quantum pocket dimension, right? Where you enter a space that appears to be X amount of space, and then you walk in, and it is far larger, like incomprehensible. So that's just my argument.
Yeah, like, I mean, maybe, you know, it's interesting. I'm not sure if they ever really, I don't remember if they actually dug it out or whatever. Like, it was a very interesting looking picture.
Yeah, I remember seeing the photographs of it. It was like petrified wood.
Yeah, it's like just brown and almost kind of conforms to the mountain. But yeah, more specifically, upon looking it up quick, it was actually found in Turkey at Mount Ararat. And if you type in and Google anywhere, just Noah's Ark found. You can see pictures of it. It's very interesting. I've looked into it into the past. I don't remember like a lot of what I've read. Other than that, it was just a weird type of find. And I don't think it was conclusive, but So I don't know. It's kind of digressing, but it's an interesting.
It really is weird concept. To have a gigantic boat that high up on a mountain.
Yeah, and it also looks really weird, especially in modern times. But
Noah had never built boats, right? Is that how that story goes? Like, he wasn't really exactly like had experience. He wasn't in there like, all right, well, the bow needs to look like this.
Like, yeah, it's like the mathematic proportions laid out in front of him, like some freaking like he's like mathematician.
I got wood and a hammer. Let's do this thing.
Yeah, like, and if I remember correctly, I think they had like two of every type of animal at that time come on to the ark.
Yeah, like God called them and they pulled up.
Yeah, like, all of them did. All of them.
Yeah. I mean, my man Noah, like, that's my favorite story in the entire Bible. Revelations is my favorite book. Noah's Ark is my favorite story because God came down and was like, build a boat. And Noah was like, all right.
He's like, all right, dude.
Like, he's just
Boom, what's up?
and everybody in the town just pulls up hard on him, too. Yeah. And they're like, oh, you're crazy. Like, you're stupid. And he's like,
it's like, dude.
Whatever. Like, this big spirit that could poof me into non-existence. Because he felt like it told me to do it. So I'm not playing with that.
Yeah, no, I'm just going to obey and keep moving here.
He said, do it. I'm doing it.
Yep.
And y'all are going to feel real dumb in a couple of days.
Yeah, once you're drowning. And me and all the freaking animals in the world are chilling on my boat. And we're living. And we're flowing. Until the new world comes by.
Although we need to talk to him about the mosquitoes.
Yeah, dude. He should have left off the mosquitoes, right? It's a good idea. Like, dude, man, I mean, I know God told you to do this, man, but I'm pretty sure the mosquitoes could have been dropped from the boat, dude.
Right. Like, what are they doing? Nothing.
Yeah, like, I'm pretty sure I think malaria, if I remember correctly hearing this, malaria is responsible for the most human deaths in history.
Oh, yeah. Mosquitoes are like one of the most deadly animals on the planet.
Yeah, dude. The mosquitoes.
Yep.
I mean, I know it's like nature's way of probably, population control and all that shit.
If I remember how malaria comes about correctly, it's like a mosquito has to bite a number of people who have different blood types. The combination of that blood type flourishes the whatever microbe that is that causes malaria. And when they bite you, boom, you have it.
It's so wild, dude. Just something as simple as that, like a little bug, you know, coming around, chilling on your arm. You know, it could just wipe you out. And so many people. But yeah, that was a fun little talk. But it all stems from the Bible, and the Bible itself. We're gonna go based off of the Catholic system, which is because you know the Roman Catholic system of Christianity, or you know, just dealing with the Bible in general, is to my knowledge the biggest that we have, and it's the one I was raised with as well. The Catholic Bible has 73 books that are canonized within the book, meaning that's what's officially approved. So the 73 books, the Old Testament has 46 books in Catholicism, and that deals with, you know, it deals with the Torah, which is like the Pentateuch, the first five books that was written by Moses. And I think they were compiled around like 1300 BC, somewhere around there. And with Christianity, I know we touched upon the Old Testament and Judaism, but Christianity specifically has spawned because of the New Testament, which was added onto the Old Testament, which is reported to have answered answered the prophecies in the Old Testament of a prophet to come, the Son of God, etc., being the incarnation of Jesus in the New Testament. And the New Testament deals primarily with Jesus's life, ministry, and what's to come in the future, you know, as shown in Revelation, which is a pretty fascinating book. And I think it was written by a hermit, too. It was kind of like a weird book that they kind of added on or tacked onto the end of the book that dealt with, I think it was like there's some dragon that comes out of the ocean with like seven heads with some crowns that's like Leviathan equated to like the devil and like darkness. And I think that was the book that dealt with the number of the beast, 666. And also, I think in Revelation, I'm 100% sure, but I think it was Revelation that it says in Revelation that there's only going to be 144,000 people that make it to heaven. 144,000 people, man. So you guys better start getting your morality correct, dude, because you got a lot of competition, guys.
Yeah, chances are we already didn't make the cut.
Yeah, man, that's a scary thought.
I mean, if you think about that, that number was probably picked at a time where if you had 3 million people in an area, that was a lot. Like, a lot.
Yeah, especially at the time, right?
We have, what, 360 million in America alone now. Like, America, like United States alone, we have more people in this country than existed at that time.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
In the entire world.
Yeah, that's wild. Yeah, that's weird, man. It's weird how we spawn so many people. I wonder where that's gonna go. But I know there's a lot of you know, of course, with a lot of the numbers in the Bible, there's could be a lot of metaphysical meanings behind a lot of these things that I subscribe to. That's what they mean underlying the just the literal print. I forget exactly what I read about 144. I know it has a lot of metaphysical significances. I think even significances in sacred geometry and the signs of music and et cetera. So it could be some type of like hidden code in there. Maybe we can explore the hidden codes of the Bible in a future episode or something like that, because there's a lot of hidden things in there that not a lot of people consider or think about or even know about. So even the number 666, you know, a lot of people really attribute that to the devil. Well, there could be like a hidden significance with that number. That's pretty much the Bible. There's other books that have not been added into the Bible throughout time that have been found at later times and that, you know, most churches have not included into their canonical texts or their official version of their Bible. One of those is the Books of Enoch. And this is a very fascinating book to me. I actually read the Books of Enoch a while ago. And if anyone's interested in reading the version I read, it's a red cover. It's just titled The Books of Enoch, The Complete Volume. And in the Books of Enoch, there's actually three of them. A lot of people kind of think there's like one. And a lot of sources says there's two, but there's actually three. There's three in total. So the first Book of Enoch is the Ethiopic Book of Enoch. The second book is the Slavonic Secrets of Enoch. And the third book of Enoch is the Hebrew Book of Enoch. And like I was saying, the book that I've read that contained all three of these, and at the time, I considered it to be maybe the best translation or the best compilation that they had at the time of them. So it's just the one I went with. And it was by the author Joseph B. Lumpkin. And so it was a very fascinating book because it spoke about a lot of concepts and things and the Bible that weren't really completely elaborated on. Like I think like the different levels of heaven, how like the wind operates through this, like just a lot of metaphysical, interesting topics and things along those lines. And it speaks also a lot about like the morality of the deluge, you know, the origins of demons, other interesting explanations. And it was also written like a while ago. It was written they speculate between 300 and 100 BC.
In all seriousness, isn't Enochian supposed to be the language of the angels?
Yeah, they say Enochian is the language of the angels, but I think that came at a later time. Like Enoch is relative to the angel Metatron. If anyone's heard of Metatron, he's kind of highly known and renowned in like metaphysical circles or esoteric circles, and he was supposed to be like one of the God's right hand angels. And Enoch, who is a prophet, who you know apparently wrote these books, and I think he was also you can also find Enoch in the Bible, I think, in various places as well. He once he had ascended, and I believe it was once he was ascended to his proper place, or like he completed his mission or whatever, he became the angel Metatron, and he went up to heaven and became one with God. And Enoch became Archangel Metatron, and that's an angel that you don't really hear about too much in just formal religious circles.
I think most commonly a lot of us would associate that with the character from Supernatural.
Yeah,
and that guy was a huge jerk.
Was he? I never seen the show. I've heard a lot about
in Supernatural.
Though.
Metatron is a huge jerk. He's selfish. He doesn't really like people, which isn't really historically accurate.
That's the thing with that show, Supernatural, and a lot of things I've heard about it. Like, if anyone watches that show, I'm sure it's a great show, but
it's wonderful. I love it so much.
Have you seen, like, all of it? Or?
Every single episode.
Damn, really?
I'm waiting for the last season to come out, because I can't just watch one. I have to binge.
How many seasons are there, Dan?
I think this is the 15th season that comes out.
15th?
It's the final one. 14th or 15th, yeah.
Damn, man, they're serious with this.
I've seen every single episode of that show.
Yeah, well, I mean, I even like some of the friends I know like have told me about it. They say I should watch it, and this. I mean, I don't have a lot of time. Otherwise, I would. But yeah, I heard it's a very good show. So I guess you're adding on to that idea. Yeah, but if anyone watches Supernatural, based off the things I've heard about it, or, you know, I know there's a lot of characters in there that can be found in religious circles or esoteric circles and all that, and they kind of like compile them together and formulate this, I think, like alternate storyline where they all come together and there's like, I don't know, things along those lines, right?
God's name is Chuck.
Really?
In the show, yeah. Like,
very weird.
Yeah, and he doesn't like being called God. He wants you to call him Chuck.
What?
Like...
All right, Chuck.
Take that show for entertainment purposes, yes. Because they use characters and they sort of embody a little bit of their personalities. But like Crowley becomes the king of hell.
Oh, Crowley's in that show?
He's a major character.
Wow, man.
He's like a fat little portly guy. Wow. Which isn't accurate either. He wasn't a fat little portly guy.
No, he wasn't.
But it's a great show. And it uses the characters and it embodies some of their personality traits, but it's not accurate to the characters within religious context.
Yeah, no, that's what I was going to say. Like, if anyone's watching this show based off what I've heard, and just like what CJ just said, like, oh, just take it with a grain of salt. Don't believe the storylines that they're telling you. I mean, it's entertainment. It's a spinoff of the actual, you know, stories that these characters actually follow, and it seems they obviously play around, have fun with the names and things. So just don't take it literally. It's entertainment. Interestingly enough, these books of Enoch, they were found, I think, in like these jars. They were found in 1948 in these caves, in the Judean desert, and they were called the Qumran Cave or the Qumran Caves. I'm probably butchering the name or whatever, but it's actually in these caves in the desert are actually the same caves in the same location in which the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, which is the books that we're going to be speaking about next. Just to summarize the books of Enoch, it kind of plays a lot on the imagination, and it really opens your eyes. It's like a lot of metaphysical concepts of like heaven and how things operate with the earth and the universe, and there's a lot of repetition in them, but it was a lot more interesting to just like reading historical writings in the Bible or like a lot of the books. It really did captivate me when I was reading it. So if anyone's interested in like alternate stories or books that were left out of the Bible or could have even been in the Bible or books that can be in the Bible in different branches, I would highly suggest looking into that version I had mentioned earlier, or just anyone that you find resonates with you. And remember, there's three in total, and some books some versions or modern versions omit at least one or two of them. So just be on the lookout and make sure that has three. Dead Sea Scrolls. These were Jewish texts discovered around 1946 and 1947. So pretty much around the exact same time the books of Enoch were discovered. These scrolls were dated from around 300 BC to 100 AD. So they're written anywhere between there. Of course, a lot of these are speculative. I mean, it's probably impossible to truly know when these were actually written. But it really plays on the imagination, like what was going on at that time, like who wrote these, how were they inspired, like it's just like, is there a reason that we in our lifetime have been around to see these things being unraveled to their extent? Like, it's very interesting how a lot of these holy texts are coming out in recent times. And the Dead Sea Scrolls were commonly attributed to the Essenes. And the Essenes was a Jewish ascetic sect. I'm not sure. I think they might have mentioned them in the Bible, maybe not. But the Essenes was another school of Jewish thought that a lot of people feel that Jesus himself was like affiliated with and got a lot of his like metaphysical or divine knowledge from. So like a lot of mystical texts will say, talk about Jesus was influenced or even had run with the Essenes for a long time. And that's how he got to his level of ascension or was able to do the things he was able to do. That's a whole other side of the coin. But overall, in terms of the authorship of the Dead Sea Scrolls being attributed to the Essenes, it's overall uncertain, even modern times. There's a lot of speculation that it wasn't the Essenes and it was all these other groups of people. You know, of course, like who knows, you know what I mean? The Dead Sea Scrolls are, unfortunately, they're books I have not gotten to read yet, but they're definitely ones I have a high interest in reading in the future. And interestingly enough, the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it just shows the relevancy that these books have to the actual Bible. I mean, it doesn't really seem to be coincidence, but I believe the Dead Sea Scrolls have fragments of every single book in the Old Testament, except for one of them. I think it was like the Book of Esther or something like that. So it has fragments of every single Old Testament book found within it. So that's interesting, you know? That's pretty much wraps up for the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah. I don't really have any other Christian texts myself.
Okay. Yeah, and there's one more I kind of wanted to touch on. And this is another one I wanted to really, really wanted to read for a while now. Of course, there's a billion books I want to read, but there's just no time. So this one is the Gospel of Thomas. And so the Gospel of Thomas, this was discovered near Nag Hammadi, Egypt in 1945, kind of around the same time as the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Books of Enoch. And it was dated anywhere to have been written between 60 and 140 AD. And what I like about the Gospel of Thomas is that it contains, amongst other things, 114 sayings that were attributed to Jesus. So it's a book that has within it just a lot of wisdom and just a lot of key points that Jesus had said, or at least apparently had said. So it's kind of like more direct to the point, and that's what I like about it. Like, there's not too much just history involved in terms of what he's saying and all those things. Like, it just gets down to the point and kind of elaborates and highlights a lot of his ideas on wisdom and just thought-provoking lines. So that's one that's definitely intriguing. If anyone's interested in the area, is like fascinated by the character of Jesus mystically or literally, it might be a book that's worth checking out. So, and then we come to Islam. And I think currently Christianity is the world's biggest religion.
Islam would be the fastest growing, I believe.
Yeah, Islam is the fastest growing and second in line, I believe. Mm-hmm. So most likely Islam is going to overtake Christianity, which is interesting because the Quran, which is the first book I'm going to be speaking about in terms of Islam, the Quran essentially, in their line of thought, is pretty much the sequel to the Bible. It's a sequel. So Islam is pretty much the sequel to Christianity in terms of Islamic thought. And so this Quran, it was received by Muhammad. Muhammad was the prophet of Islam. And initially he wasn't able to write. He wasn't, at least to my knowledge, really highly skilled enough to be able to come to a fabrication of these things. So it seems to me to be some type of divinely inspired or at least spiritually inspired text.
Yeah, he wrote the book between 1610 and 1632 AD, which was at the time of his death. And early talks of Muhammad, he actually, lack of a better term, he hung out in a poorer district where he was at. And accumulated a following. And at first he wasn't very prominent. And then it was almost like they took a nap, woke up, and he was everywhere.
Well, it's interesting. Well, I guess like a slight correction, just so listeners don't get confused. It was transmitted to Muhammad by Angel Gabriel, or I think in Arabic it was like Jibriel. It started with a J, but I think it's pretty much Angel Gabriel. It was transmitted throughout 23 years between 610 and 632 AD. So it was a period of like 23 years that this mm-hmm. that this angel apparently revealed all these things to Muhammad. And if I remember correctly, it all started within a cave. And I think Angel Gabriel came to him, and I think at first it terrorized him, this angel. And it's interesting because I was reading a lot of comments recently about like how in the Bible, like Angel Gabriel, which I believe stands for like the messenger of God, like is like Hebrew for messenger of God. Or something along those lines. How in the Bible, like, he was like, oh, you know, don't fear me when he came to people or whatever. And apparently, like, he never said that to Muhammad. Like, he just remained like this, like, terrorizing threat to Muhammad. And, like, Muhammad like, really, I think Muhammad initially thought that it was like an evil spirit trying to speak to him.
I mean, to be completely fair, if you're thinking in a realistic sense about even how you would react to something like that, First of all, we have an image in our heads of what angels look like because of pictures we've seen of them painted, what people have imagined them, but chances are they don't look like people with bird wings.
Yeah.
And in all honesty, like, if one popped into this room right now, we'd probably crap our pants. Like, it would be horrifying. And I appreciate that about that story of Muhammad, where he's like, I was terrified. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I get that. I would be too, man.
Like, yeah, like, it's like, yeah, that's the problem I have with mainstream religion, not religion itself. That's what the problem I have with how they fabricate and sell mainstream religions. Like, I grew up my whole life, from like when I was a child up to like 16. Just my childhood. Like, I remember just all the time being like instilled within me all these children books about the Bible and like all these like child story books, you know, that pertain to a lot of the parables and Jesus and things like that being read to me, and like how the pictures looked and everything. And everything just looks like so sugar coated, like just rainbows and like everything's so happy and everyone's living this great life. And there's this Jesus guy, and just the way he's portrayed, he doesn't even look like he comes from like Jerusalem or whatever. He doesn't have like that type of brown skin or whatever, or that type of hair. Like,
well, that picture has an interesting story behind it. They were looking for an image to associate Jesus with. They picked I believe this was in France, and they picked this artist on the street, and it was a drunken artist, and he said okay, and then he did a self-portrait.
Interesting. Yeah, I also heard that the modern day version of Jesus was taken after an emperor's son, I believe, who was named Michael. And they took his face, and that became one of the modern day versions, which is why he kind of looks white with like wavy brown hair. I don't know. I mean, maybe yours is. I don't know.
There's a whole bunch of stories about where that picture came from, because the reality is no one truly knows where it came from. So there's, I think I've read five or six different things. There was actually a story, an article that I read recently, in a spiritual forum that I take part in, where they really took the Bible, and then they took firsthand accounts of Jesus from like the Greeks, Romans.
Yeah.
And they reconstructed from those descriptions what he actually looked like. And he was definitely Middle Eastern in color.
Yeah.
The hair was not white man's hair.
It was more like nappy. It was more thick, right?
I guess I wouldn't go as far as to say nappy, but it was definitely, I believe the Bible describes it as of wool.
Okay.
I believe is how the Bible describes it.
Yeah, just thicker.
And then in Greek, and I believe it was one of the big philosophers who, he actually wrote that Jesus was annoying.
He was annoying?
That's what he wrote. He said that he wore a one-piece tunic and nothing else, and sandals, which is strange because a one-piece tunic at that time period would have been something a child would have worn as an undergarment.
Interesting.
And if you saw a grown man wearing a one-piece tunic such as that, it was a signal that he was very poor and very homeless, which matches the description of Jesus throughout the Bible. He wasn't exactly affluent.
Yeah, I think he was probably pretty ascetic.
Yeah, and then these philosophers and like these other witness accounts of this man said that, you know, he aligned himself with the poor, with the destitute. He tried to bring them hope, and he would oftentimes ask for money to feed himself and whatnot, but he would never take like greedy amounts. Like, super interesting article about and then there's a picture that was drawn too, like where they did this reconstruction based on all these descriptions from these different things, that was, what's the word I'm looking for? Consistent?
Are you talking about the one that was in Time Magazine?
No.
Okay.
No, this was a more recent thing. And, yeah, like, you look at that and you're like, oh, that was definitely Jesus. That, like, that's geographically correct, like, you see all these different descriptions, these different artworks, and you're like, that looks nothing like the guy I saw in the picture at church.
Well, that's the thing. Like, it's just like growing up, like I was saying, like, I had like all these, like, just, I had a complete different view back then, a more superficial sugar-coated version of what Christianity was, like, thrusted into me, like, in my mind when I was a kid. And as I grew older and actually read the stories in the Bible for what they actually were and the descriptions of everything, it's just so much different. And like, just how they sell the religion to people on the market, to me, is just almost kind of blasphemous. Like, and it does kind of brainwash a lot of people as a child to have this certain type of like idea of how all these things go, and you know, that going into a child's mind, I don't know. To me, I'm not really for 100%, but you know, whatever works. It's just to me, I think it caused damage to me because it made me perceive the world in such a way that it really wasn't. Especially when you come down to the source of the Bible, it's just different. It's not the same thing. But yeah, I mean, in terms of what I was saying with the Time magazine, if everyone's interested, they did, I suppose it like did like this reconstruction of what they perceived Jesus to actually look like, and this image can be, you can type into Google, there's this image on the cover of a Time magazine. I remember it came out when I think I was in elementary school, maybe like 18, 19 years ago or so, 20 years ago. Like, I remember specifically in my mind, and it's a kind of realistic version of what he looks like. He has brown skin, he has a thicker curly hair, and just the way the facial expression was on his face, it just looked like one of mercy, just one of it just looks so much different than what we perceive him to look like today. It's almost baffling. It really kind of jogs your mind compared to what, you know, what we're being shown all the time. But yeah, that's just a little fun thing to look up. But this all comes back from the Quran that we were speaking about. Angel Gabriel came down to Muhammad, and I believe that as he was in his trances and as the angel was speaking through him, he was able to have such eloquence of speech, and he had scribes, and I think the scribes wrote down all the things that were being transmitted through him. And the Quran itself ended up containing 114 chapters. And it, interestingly enough, and something I really appreciate about it, and something that the, a lot of Muslims like, are very prideful with their holy text in terms of the Quran, is that it is pretty much like the only, if not like one of the only, religious texts that we have, and it's complete in original form. Like, it's unadulterated. It's not abridged. It's not messed around with. It's apparently in its original form, word for word, at least in the Arabic form. Of course, every translation, you lose some meaning and semblances and stuff like that, but its original Arabic form is how it was, directly from the word, from the mouth of Muhammad, which is very, it's awesome. It's interesting. Definitely compels me to really read it more in the future. I've read parts of it, The Cow, the first book of the Quran, and a couple other parts of it. But yeah, so that it's just very intriguing. What else was I going to say about the Quran, man?
I think one of the biggest things that it promoted, at least early on in the book, was religious tolerance, where Muhammad told somebody, that may be your religion, but this is mine. And there was no negativity to that interaction.
Okay.
It was very, yeah, very tolerant of each other, which I thought was interesting, because that's not something you come across very often with religious texts, of it being tolerant of other religions.
Yeah, it's usually, I guess, like in the Bible, at least the Ten Commandments of Moses, like, you should not have other gods besides me. Mm-hmm. And that's like a really serious, you know, that's a commandment.
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
later on, it doesn't maintain that sort of attitude. And there's theories behind why that would change as culture changes into, you know, either from like nomadic tribes and smaller communities to larger, or what you would consider like a metropolis of the time period.
Yeah.
So the culture change, the story progresses from there. I mean, mind you, he wrote this over the course of 23 years.
Yeah. It was a long time, and it's a tragedy what happened to Muhammad. You know, he eventually was murdered, and just a lot of bad things, you know, had happened to him. As with a lot of virtuous, great, holy men across time.
Yeah,
you know?
Like, even Krishna, like his story. There was a battle that broke out, and someone mistook him for a deer and shot him with an arrow.
Jeez, man, you just can't win, dude.
And,
you know,
while he was apparently curled in the fetal position sleeping. And they took him for a deer and shot him with an arrow.
Wow.
And apparently the man that shot him ran over, he forgave the man and passed away. It's a very common theme in many religious texts.
Yeah, and even with Jesus, you know, the most widely known death of a prophet or son of God, or whatever you want to call it, you know, the crucifixion by Pontius Pilate, ordered by him. And it's just, I don't know, it's very... it's just a shame how you have, whether they were real or false accounts, you know, just these stories of such holy and you know, apparently good men, or the top of the line good men, you know, you send them down here to good old earth, you know, aka some semblance of hell seemingly, you know, and like these people just get slaughtered for just speaking truth and being kind, you know. It's just so contradictory as to what, you know, we feel should be happening,
or at least spreading spirituality.
Yeah, or like introducing, I guess at the end of the day, it's just introducing alternate ideas and ways of life into a society that either wasn't ready for it, is ignorant, or just doesn't want to hear anything about it. It's just weird, you know. It's just no open-mindedness, you know.
That even carries on today.
It does. Yeah, it does. A lot of dams in the consciousness of a lot of people.
So do we have anything else then?
For Islam, there's also like the hadith, or the hadith, and I'm 100% sure how to say it. And that means in English, talk or discourse. And the hadith is comprised of the words and actions of Muhammad, which, you know, was compiled much later after the death of Muhammad. So, you know, there's been much speculation for a lot of people. As to whether or not it's authentic, as if it should be followed or not. It's speculated by some groups that it was fabricated and that it shouldn't be introduced into Islamic thought and lifestyle. But others remain pretty adamant that it's a very worthwhile and authentic. But it's an interesting topic, but I think it does deal a lot with, you know, just morality and structures of society and how to live your life. And like I was saying, it dealt with the ways of the life of Muhammad himself. But whether or not it's real or not, you know, up in the air. Just like about a lot of other things. And that's what I have for a couple of the most prominent texts in Islam. Of course, there's various others and all these religions that we've spoken about today. But these are just, we're just dealing with the most prominent, religious texts. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And we have something about the Baha'i faith, right? Which is like one of the more modern and most, one of the most prominent New Age religions today that has spawned.
It's comprised of two books, The Seven Valleys and The Four Valleys. It was written in 1857.
Okay. I'm actually surprised it wasn't written more recent than that.
Yeah, it's, that picked up more steam more recently than that. Oh, okay. But it was written in 1857. And the whole purpose of those books is the journey to God. Your personal journey to God, and they emphasize reason, obedience, and inspiration.
Okay. Yeah, if I remember correctly, I think the author of that book had a really interesting name. Let's try to find it quick.
That was another one of those names, I believe, that I couldn't pronounce, so I didn't try.
Yeah, I know. I remember seeing his name like a while ago. But yeah. It was written by this guy named by like Baha'u'llah, something like that. Baha'u'llah, something like that, who is the founder of the Baha'i faith. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and that's a faith that, you know, we've spoken about that in a previous episode. If you guys, like I said, if you guys want to have any type of, if you guys are interested in actually learning about like all the religions that we just followed, like the actual religions themselves, like overview of the religion themselves, and not just the texts, we pretty much cover that in a previous episode titled Religious and Spiritual Traditions, where we just go into, you know, overviews and foundational ideas about the religions themselves, mm-hmm. and not just the texts. So, yeah, we had a little section of the Baha'i faith there, and that pretty much just comprises that, you know, that they believe that you can find truth, and there's truth in every religion. You know, there's diamonds in all the hay, and there's diamonds in all the rough, or there's something of importance across every tradition. You just have to, you know, find it, and whatever resonates with you, it works.
Yeah, we miss Shintoism.
Shintoism, yeah, I've heard of that one. I actually don't know anything about Shintoism.
It's more metaphysical.
Is it?
Yeah, and the it's actually older than some of the religions we spoke about today. And the main book of that is the Kojiki.
The Kojiki.
It was translated to English in 1882. And this is, it's mostly a record of customs, ceremonies, and magical practices within Shintoism.
Interesting.
It's a large emphasis on spirit interaction, ancestors, things like that.
Yeah, and I guess that originated in Japan.
Yeah, yeah. So they don't have a main deity, a god, per se.
Okay.
Where everything is if I'm remembering correctly how that religion works, it puts a lot of emphasis on your ancestors and guardian spirits and things like that. And your ancestors guide you along until you get to the their form of the afterlife in itself. And there is a ton of magical practice involved.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, and just upon looking at it quick, yeah, I guess the one of the primary beliefs is that they believe that humans are fundamentally good and that evil in general is caused by just evil spirits. So I guess that's an important, I mean, a little interesting part of Shintoism, you know?
Yeah, they have a whole bunch of neat little spirits, like Tsukumogami is something. And the other show that I do called Cryptotechnical, we actually have an entire episode on Tsukumogami. But basically the premise behind that is you have an object that was taken care of but not used for 100 years, and a spirit embodies it, and it comes alive.
So it's almost kind of like some type of version of a golem to some degree.
In a way, except...
Just not its formation?
It's not willed by a human.
Yeah, just not...
Into the vessel. Yeah. It comes alive on its own accord.
On its own, yeah.
And sometimes they can be cool and they can help you out. Sometimes they can be awful.
Okay.
Like shoes can come alive, wrenches, your plunger. Anything that, as long as it's not been touched for 100 years, but it has also not been left to degrade.
It's interesting. You know, like, I've always wondered, like, you know, if I was a spirit, like, how it would feel, like, the vessel, like, or, like, the astral body of it, and, like, if I were to will myself into an object, how that would feel. You know, like, just, like, you can't move the object, or maybe you can, but, like, just how it would feel, like, just conforming to some object. I don't know. It's kind of a weird thought. But, yeah. I guess that's...
Yeah, there's a spiritual text, too, that I kind of wanted to bring up real quick before we close out. Excuse my ignorance. I don't actually know what this one goes with, but it's from the philosopher Lao Tzu.
Lao Tzu, yes.
And it's called the Tao Te Ching. And then this spiritual text actually promotes duality, balance, compassion. You achieve harmony through freedom from greed, desire, and judgment. Basically, the concept of separating yourself from the ego.
Okay. I think he also had another. Was he the one that wrote The Art of War?
No. That was Sun Tzu.
Yeah, Sun Tzu. I always get those two confused. So, yeah, anyway, that's that was just a little question I had. But, yeah, okay, all right. So, yeah, that pretty much summarizes the primary, just the primary religious and spiritual texts that, you know, that are still in effect today. Hopefully it gave you guys, like, a deeper insight into, you know, kind of the dynamics of what made up a lot of these religions. Because at the end of the day, like we said in the beginning, these have been thoughts and texts that have influenced probably every avenue that allowed us to get to where we were today, for better or for worse, probably most likely for better. Because without a lot of this wisdom, there would be so much more suffering. And that's what I love about wisdom. That's why philosophy is very interesting and important to me. Because it kind of allows the human mind to navigate all the chaos and uncertainty and the unsettlement of life. It kind of puts it into an organized way of viewing things so that you are able to understand the mechanics of life and suffer less. That's just I just love that about, you know, just the concept of wisdom.
Yep. And anybody who is sitting here wondering, why did I just listen to this episode? What does that have to do with my magical path? Many, many magical paths are based in these texts, and the information provided within as you move down your path is also, you're going to be pulling information from these texts, names, places, events. Lots of ceremonies are derived from these texts, and in future episodes we'll be getting more in-depth to that, especially when we do in-depth looks at things such as the Esoteric Order of the Golden Dawn. We'll be pulling a lot of information from that. So if you have any sort of interest or you're feeling compelled into looking to any of these, we do recommend it, because the information that's contained within these texts is going to become extremely relevant as we move through this podcast series.
Yeah, and even if you are a part of one of these religions, you know, just like even say like Christianity or whatever, like Judaism, or if you have any interest in opening the mind to other avenues that are kind of resemblant of those areas of life, you know, such as, like, you know, like in Christianity, say, like the books of Enoch or the Gospel of Thomas, you know, books like that. If you're open-minded enough to, you know, venture out and check out books that could have been actually part of the Bible, if, you know, if the councils in Nicaea or all the organized churches didn't say that they shouldn't be in there. There's a lot of relevant information that kind of corroborates things that are in the Bible, and there's a lot of interesting ideas that can, you know, stimulate the imagination or grant you a different perception as to a lot of things that you might already know, maybe a better, deeper understanding, if you don't think it's blasphemous. But yeah, just they're just important areas, I think, if you are more prone to just seeking truth.
Right, and just to expand on that a little bit, that's also going to come extremely relevant when we move into more of our philosophical thoughts and episodes where we cover the advancement of spirituality and your transcendence on a spiritual level. We'll instill right now, like, not every episode is going to have to do with magic. I think we mentioned that before.
Yeah, that's one thing I fear. I don't want everyone to like, this is not a magic-only podcast. We started off with the topics of magic just because it's a passion of ours, and it's very interesting. So we start off with that. But at the end of the day, this podcast is just all about truth, just, you know, delving into the unknown, just everything and anything that can inspire the mind to go beyond the superficial and hopefully allow one to understand just reality and themselves and the world just deeper. And that's the primary focus.
Yeah, hopefully we can help you. Maybe not necessarily directly help you. We'd like to directly help you, but point you in the right direction to that spiritual transcendence. And yes, it is going to involve magic at times, but don't hold it against us if not every episode is about that.
Yeah, and eventually, it won't be probably at all when we venture into like philosophy and mathematics, you know, even UFO stuff. You know, just there's going to be so many different areas that you guys are going to see that we're going to be covering in the future. And we're looking heavily forward to, you know, venturing off into those avenues.
And not to say that we're going to forget about those practices altogether, because there's definitely going to be things where it's relevant. And maybe we'll even do like bonus episodes, something like that, to give you that if that's what you're, if you're interested in that sort of thing. I know some of the communities that I promote this show within are very magic-heavy communities. So we're not going to forget about that completely, but moving forward, this is not going to be solely focused.
No, not whatsoever, yeah. And, of course, there's going to be a lot of parallels and a lot of interesting ideas that will spawn in other areas that we cover that might have correlations or overlappings within magic or metaphysics or philosophy that, of course, we'll bring into and, you know, try to make a collective whole or at least introduce different theories that we have as to what a lot of these things are. So, yeah, until then, we really appreciate you guys listening once more. Thank you so much for your time. Every click means a lot to me and CJ. And if there's any questions you have or just anything you want to tell us or let us know or even correct us on, you know, we're here to learn as well, not only to teach or have fun, but also to learn as well. You can contact us on Instagram at mystery.stone.podcast. You just send us a message, you know, see what's up. And we're also going to be having posts on our Instagram that kind of, you know, overview and give a little structure as to the, you know, episodes we've done and little things in between as well. So, yeah, message us on Instagram. And we also have a Gmail, mystery.stone.podcast@gmail.com. So, yeah, anything you guys have to say, just shoot us a message, and we greatly, greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, and if you feel so kind, please leave us a review on iTunes, on Podchaser, and tell your friends about us.
Yeah, and until then, thank you so much once more, and I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your day or night.
Blessed be.
Take care.